Local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the New York Relief Network, medical missions bringing critical care to people all over the world with over 700 volunteers. We'll learn about their mission to bring critical, timely, and compassionate care to marginalized and underserved communities. Two healthy meals. Every student in our schools should get one daily. That's the goal and the vision of the Sullivan Nutrition Action Coalition. They're on the move for healthier, locally and regionally sourced food in our school cafeterias, and Sullivan 180 is part of that coalition. They're here with an update on their progress. The 20th annual Lark in the Park at Catskill Park begins this Friday. Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors tells us about all the larking going on and the Thanksgiving play at River Rep Theater. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing revenge against Iran after Iran attacked Israel yesterday with scores of ballistic missiles. One person was killed in the West Bank. An Iranian diplomat is warning if Israel retaliates, a, quote, crushing response would ensue. The UN Security Council is set to hold an emergency meeting this hour on the escalating situation in the Middle East. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
The UN Security Council is expected to meet in open session in which member states, including Israel, Iran, and Lebanon, will be permitted to speak. Closed-door consultations among council members will follow. Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Danon, told reporters Tuesday that Israel wants the Security Council to condemn Iran's ballistic missile attack on his country. However, such an action would likely be blocked by Russia and China, both allies of Iran. Meanwhile, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has issued a statement condemning what he called the broadening of the Middle East conflict with escalation after escalation. He said a ceasefire was needed. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo in New York.
Meanwhile, Israel is barring the UN Secretary General from entering the country, alleging he hasn't done enough to condemn Iran's attack. The vice presidential candidates held their only scheduled debate last night in New York. NPR's Franco Ordonez says the exchange between Ohio Senator J.D. Vance and Minnesota Governor Tim Walz was mainly cordial.
To me, it was clear that Vance was the more polished candidate. He was more comfortable in the spotlight, backing down, back questions and critiques. Walz, he started off a little rusty, but improved as time went on, especially when he was talking about that signature issue of their campaign, reproductive rights. Perhaps, though, the best moment for Walz was at the end, though, when pressing Vance directly on Trump and the 2020 election.
NPR's Franco Ordonez reporting. Stocks opened lower this morning as tensions in the Middle East pushed crude oil prices higher. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 16 points in early trading.
The U.S. benchmark for crude oil jumped back above $70 a barrel after Iran fired a barrage of missiles into Israel, most of which were intercepted. Retail gasoline prices showed little change. AAA reports the average price of regular gas is $3.20 a gallon, a penny less than a week ago and 61 cents lower than this time last year. Stock in Nike opened down after the shoemaker reported a 10% drop in quarterly sales. Nike's bringing back a veteran executive to serve as CEO. Elliot Hill starts work in less than 2 weeks. Tens of thousands of dock workers remain on strike at ports along the East and Gulf Coast. The Longshoremen's Union is demanding higher pay and limits on automation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 20 points. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. President Biden will visit both North and South Carolina today for briefings on storm recovery efforts. Vice President Harris will go to Georgia. More than 160 people have been killed by Hurricane Helene. Damage in several states is catastrophic. North Carolina elections officials say they plan to start early in-person voting as scheduled on October 17th. That includes in counties that have been flooded by the storm. From member station WFAE in Charlotte, Steve Harrison reports.
The head of North Carolina's Elections Board, Karen Brinson Bell,
says 12 county elections boards still aren't open, and she doesn't yet know whether all early voting sites will be usable.
There may be polling places affected by mudslides. There may be polling places inaccessible because of damaged roads. There may be polling places with trees that have fallen on them.
She says the state could set up temporary voting sites in tents if needed. The storm has devastated many counties in the western part of the state, most of which voted overwhelmingly for former President Trump in 2020. North Carolina is seen by both Democrats and Republicans as a crucial state in November. For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
Officials in Florida are warning people who have electric vehicles to keep them away from water as hurricane recovery continues. These can catch fire because water and batteries, especially lithium-ion batteries, should not mix. There are reports of EV fires in Tampa, Florida. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at WTGrantFoundation.org. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The New York Relief Network sends nurses and medical professionals on medical missions around the world where they're needed most. They partner with registered nurses, nurse practitioners, doctors, and other healthcare professionals, and over 700 volunteers helping to deliver critical, timely, and compassionate care to marginalized and underserved communities. Joining us now is Roni Curvello, the current director of the New York Relief Network. And joining us in the studio is a volunteer with Radio Catskill and a volunteer with the New York Relief Network, Tom Candela. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, and thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to you and to your listeners about New York Relief Network work.
Thank you. And Roni, how does this work? You know, we were just hearing on NPR News about the devastation of Hurricane Helene here in the United States. Of course, there's devastation throughout the world with various wars and conflicts going on. How does the New York Relief Network go into these areas to help?
Okay. First of all, we don't do necessarily disasters, because especially in the United States, because of the law, the United States, you have to go through the government. So there is an agency called ICN, and those are the ones responsible to take care of the states in cases of emergency or case of disasters. We do volunteer, but we depend on them to accept or not our nurses and people that work with the Newark NYRN on a regular basis as a volunteer. So what we do most of the time is go to regions outside the United States where we find a lot of underserved communities. And also because, just to give an example, in India, we go to the Dalits. The Dalits is also called the untouchable. They don't have access to health care. Well, they don't have access to anything, matter of fact, but especially for the health care. So we are the ones who provide them year after year on a regular basis some kind of assistance as far as health care concern. We go to the Thailand, to the Kayan tribe. Kayan tribe. They are people that will be fled from Myanmar because of the government took their land. So they fled to Thailand. Once in Thailand, they don't have any rights, not even they have no access to health care. So there comes us providing them health care. So on and so forth. We go to the mountains of Peru, 15,000 feet, tribes, the Quechua tribes. Quechua tribes, where they have no access to assistance as well. So we provide more internationally because there is a huge need. And also because the nurses or the health professionals who participate on those missions, they are educated on the experience that they have on those places that we go. So it's like a win-win situation, not only for the patients, but also for all those people who participate in the medical missions.
And I see on your website that in 2024, your visits to Puerto Rico, Zimbabwe, Thailand, Cuba, Brazil, upcoming, plus more. How do you go about selecting these places or being selected to go to these places?
That's a great question. Thank you, Tim.
Yeah. First of all, we find the places that we can go and safely. First of all, safety is number one. A place that we do have a local connection, because the local team is essential for the success. So we need to have the patients in place. We have to have the sites in place. We need to have the medications and the supplies in place. And we have to have access to those places. So as long as we have the local team totally connected with us and know exactly what we have to do in those places that are can provide some net of safety to our members, that's the places that we go. So obviously the world is a very big, a lot of countries. We can go to any, to all of them, but we also go to like a Puerto Rico, as you said, because it is a Catano community, which is a community very poor. They don't necessarily have too much access to medications and to healthcare providers. We go to the, you mentioned Brazil, we go to the tribes, the indigenous tribe, and which is very, very interesting when you go and treat those indigenous, because it's a totally, totally different procedure. For example, when the nurse and Tom can confirm what I'm saying, when you go to talk to to do the triage, you talk to the patient, and then one of the moments you have to ask if the person has a sexual active, right? But when you go to the indigenous tribe, you cannot say that because they may don't understand what you ask. Yeah. So you have to ask, are you going to the floor? Are you constantly going to the floor? Because what they do is the sexual activity they do on the floor. They don't do in the bed because they don't have a bed to do that. So you know what I'm saying? So and that is it's a way that I'm just giving like a very simple example, but there are many.
A lot of cultural issues that we do have to take into consideration with each country that we go to. For instance, now we're getting ready right now next week, a week from today actually. I leave. We're going to Jordan. And the goal there is to work with some of the refugees from Palestinians. So there are a lot of cultural issues that we've already been educated on, that Roni actually went to the country, to Jordan, back in August to sort of case the joint, if you will, and find out where we're going to be working and what people we're going to be working with, set up our interpreters, that sort of thing. But in going there, he learns about certain cultural issues that we need to be aware of when we go. And then also to find out education-wise what some of the people need to know about, for instance, about if they're a high-risk community for diabetes or hypertension. And part of our role as providers of the healthcare, the nurses and the physician assistants or doctors, is to also educate those people. So I put together a PowerPoint presentation that we'll be presenting there in Arabic about diabetes, and another person might be doing hypertension, that sort of thing. But a lot of it is being certainly culturally aware of what the people's needs are, as well as what their healthcare is.
Oh, I have to ask, after Iran's missile attack on Israel and Israel's invasion of Lebanon, there are questions about further escalation in the region. Jordan is certainly in the middle of that area. Are you concerned at all about further escalation? Does that change your plans for this trip? Roni?
Are you talking to me?
Roni, yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, we are checking on almost every hour what's going on. My main concern right now, we follow a lot what the State Department says as far as the level of safety. So the level of safety for Jordan, it's at level 2. So it's 1 to 4. So right now we see no reason to change the plans unless the State Department changes the level of safety. This is one thing. What concerns me the most is not exactly because Iran is throwing bombs in Israel or vice versa, or because in Jordan they don't have any problems with Israel, or they are not actually they have a very good relationship. So it's as far as that I have no concerns. What concerns me the most is because the air traffic is closed. When those things happen, we don't have there are no planes flying. Yeah. So and that is my main concern right now. I'm waiting to see if Israel make a decision on attack Iran or not, or to see what happens in the next few days, and then so we can make a more intelligent decision. But as far as right now, we should keep the planes the plans, because I also spoke to Jordan this morning, and they reaffirmed that there's no issues, no reason, no safety issues in Amman, the city, the capital of Jordan. So we have to keep a big eye open and looking to see what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of concern everywhere and activity, yes. And everyone should keep an eye on the escalation in the Middle East. If you're just joining us, we are speaking to Roni Curvelo, the current director of the New York Relief Network, and volunteer Tom Candela. The New York Relief Network sends nurses and medical professionals on medical missions around the world where they are needed most. Roni, I wanted to ask, you know, as you're looking for this trip that you're keeping an eye on in Jordan, and you're obviously the need is there. But what we were talking about earlier was sometimes with some overlooked needs, as many other conflicts rise to the headlines in some ways. And you mentioned that it is all over the world. Obviously, is it overwhelming at times?
Yeah, yes, especially in the case of Africa, not necessarily you have like problems with a war, but you do have another different war, which is like disease. And we also go to the border with the United States and Mexico, and Tom be there one or two or twice,
yes.
To the border. And he knows exactly what we see it, what the need that they are. And sometimes, for example, Tom, I'm going to let him talk about it because it's very interesting. We went to this parking lot with 10,000 people.
Yes.
Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, so we were down in the area of Chapachua, which is close to the Guatemala border with Mexico. And we were scheduled to go to various camps and refugee areas to treat these people. Basically, we thought Mexican refugees coming up through the country. But what we found, or Roni discovered, that there was this open air arena where many Haitian migrants were really being almost stored. I mean, they had thousands of them, and they just put them in this open air arena. And they had no access to water, very little. They just had porta-johns outside the arena, which were filthy, piles of garbage all around the place.
Remember, they were not collecting the garbage.
Piles of trash all over the place. And these poor people, even at nighttime, they didn't even have lights. They didn't even turn on lights for them. Roni discovered were there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and when you don't have lights, you have a different problems. We have
it's
a predator.
Crime, yes.
You have people, crimes. Mm-hmm.
So we diverted one of our trips to go there to serve these people, and it was incredible. I mean, we were there for the entire day. In fact, we were there so late that they had to bring up cars and turn on their headlights to shine on our table so we could see what we were doing. We eventually ran out of medication. Roni had to run to a local pharmacy to get as much as a lot of children there with fevers and stuff, to get as much as Tylenol and ibuprofen and even antibiotics. That's a strange thing in other countries. You can go to a standard pharmacy and just buy antibiotics over the counter. So we had to go and do that in order to resupply ourselves. And we ended up staying there well past what we had thought we would be, just to help these communities. And Roni was able to through his pressure, get them, if I believe they turned on the lights for them, right? Or they provided some sort of
electric. Yeah, I went that day for the next day, actually. I went to the television and went to the radio stations, and I started giving interview, and, you know, some have put a pressure on the city that they had to do this. And the same day, they send the cars to collect the garbage, and they turn the lights at night. So it was a, it's like we not only provide the health care, but we have some, we make the city officials understand that that is was a, they are humans, and they need to treat it in different ways. So it's a lot more than we do. And the, let me go back to the Dalits in India. After we went there, they have no roads to access to their village. So I went there, I spoke to the city officials, and the next day, I mean, not that day, next day, but next week, the following week, they put a road, and the road is still exists today. So so they could, you know, get from their village to the city. That was so important. I'm very proud of the work that we do. Has been already more than 25,000 patients that we saw. We've been in 24 countries on a regular basis. We go there since 2017. We have more than 700 volunteers, and we are looking for more people who are listening to us can, because it's, Tom, go ahead.
Yes, exactly. I was hoping you'd start to talk about that. Yeah. So we are looking for additional volunteers for our group. we do have a website that you can go to. Excuse me. I think I'm working for the station. It's NewYorkReliefNetwork.org, in which you can see all of the upcoming trips that we have, not only in 2024, but the 2025 calendar is also up on that website as well. And you do not have to be necessarily in the medical field, because as Ronnie is explaining, there's many different opportunities within our group to volunteer. We could use certainly nurses and physician assistants and doctors and nurse practitioners, of course, but we also have a lot of logistics stuff, you know, people who could help interpret, people can help with crowd control, because believe it or not, you get into these places and there are literally thousands of people at times, and they're all kind of rushing us because they all want the service. And they want to make sure that they get some of the medications. So we have people who need to do crowd control. We need people who need to be our interpreters.
Registration.
There's so much more. We used to have, I don't know, we haven't done it recently, but we used to have a COVID table where everybody had to, you know, go by that table first. Anybody could do a COVID test once trained, you know, on a patient. So things like that. So if you're interested in traveling to these countries and helping, becoming part of a solution and helping people throughout these countries, please, you know, join us. Go to our website. Roni is very available. He can, you could call him. His phone number and contact information is there. And we welcome everybody to participate on these missions.
We're certainly doing that.
Yeah. The website is nyreliefnetwork.org. Mm-hmm. So nyreliefnetwork.org. And also we are in the Facebook by Instagram. So it's very easy to find, right? The name of the organization is New York Relief Network, but it's very, very easy to find. And the people also, if you won't be able to go, you can sponsor somebody else, because that's the thing. When you volunteer, you have to pay a fee to participate that covers hotel, transportation, the whole cost of the mission, which is not much, but it's a way, because we stay, and that is very important, because people want to think that, oh, I'm going to go to a mission, I'm going to be work, sleep in bunk beds, I'm going to be sleep on the floor, I'll be in hostels, I'll be this. Yeah. No.
We stay in five-star hotels, reason, basically.
We have between, depends on the country that we go, but between 3 and 5 star hotel. Because my idea is like, you don't need to be like them in order to provide the service. I need you to be fresh. I need you to be fed. I need you to be clean. I need you to feel good about you in order to help somebody else. So, yeah, you stay in very good places so you can be rested in order to help somebody else.
Well, thank you for being here and letting us know about it. It's a New York Relief Network providing compassionate, critical care to underserved communities throughout the world. We've been speaking with Ronnie Curvello, the current director of New York Relief Network, and Tom Candela, one of our volunteers, but also a volunteer for New York Relief Network. Thank you so much.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having us, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, farm to table. It's farm to school, actually. Two healthy meals daily for every student in our schools, a goal and vision of the Sullivan Nutrition Action Coalition. We'll learn more after this break. It's Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Apple Pie Palooza returns to the Catskill Brewery October 12th, kicking off Radio Catskill's fall fun drive with a lot of apple pie. Come by, eat pie, buy pie, and if you have a killer apple pie or apple dessert recipe, make it, bake it, and enter it into our baking contest. Go to WJFFradio.org to register your dessert now, or just stop by and get some pie at Apple Pie Palooza, 3 to 6, Saturday, October 12th at Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Farm to School is a community-based movement to create a better future through access to healthier food for children. In Sullivan County, community organizations, school districts, farmers, and producers are working together to build a network that can get healthy, regionally grown food from the seed to the cafeteria, with each partner focusing energy and investing resources at a place along the way. Part of that coalition called the Sullivan Nutrition Action Coalition, it's Sullivan 180. And Denise Frangipani and Cassandra Johnstone from Sullivan 180 are here to tell us more about it. Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. Oh, wait, turn your mic on. There you go. Hi.
Hello.
You asked me that. Who turns it on? I do.
Thank you for turning the mic. Hello and good morning and happy Farm to School Month.
Thank you for being here to tell us about it. Tell us more about this initiative. It's part of this bigger coalition. There's a whole month around it. You know, I kind of did a little synopsis here, but yeah. What part do you guys play in it?
So I'll start and then I'll turn over to Cassandra. So part of our work at Sullivan 180 is, you know, as you know, Tim, and we've talked about many times, we're focusing on prevention. We're focusing on our youth and empowering a healthier generation. And a lot of that work takes place in our schools. And so the cafeterias are prime real estate for working with youth, especially because for so many of our Sullivan County youth, their meals at school are going to be the best meals that they might get. So we want to make sure that those meals are healthy, delicious, nutritious, locally sourced as often as possible, and to really make that eating experience enjoyable, impactful, but also to change the palate so that young people appreciate the healthier food versus the sugary kind of additive, preservative laden foods that we've become accustomed to as a culture. Mm-hmm. So we, through a USDA grant, have been focusing on this effort. And about a year ago, we formed the School Nutrition Action Coalition, which we are facilitating, but really the work is being done in the schools. So we have school districts, we have community partners, A Single Bite in the Catskills Food Hub. We're working with the Center for Discovery, SUNY Sullivan, and really bringing a collective of viewpoints and access points around this conversation, and a few of our local farms: Iris Gillingham from Gale Roots Farm, mm-hmm. Justin Sutherland from Somewhere in Time Farm, Sprouting Dreams Farm, Eugene.
We just call him Eugene.
Eugene from Sprouting Dreams. So it's been really fun to do, and we're working with the schools to meet them where they are. And for some schools, that means they need equipment, they need access to the food product, they need the training. We just did a 2-day food service conference in August, which was, I think, really changed the whole dynamic of the way we're looking at it. And then resources.
Cassandra, tell us a little bit more. How is it going? And how are the kids reacting?
So I think that the kids are really finding this to be an interesting time because a lot of the cafeterias are piloting some of these recipes. So they're really getting their input heard. But on the resource end of it, as Denise was saying, we're meeting people where they are, schools where they are. So that means different things for different schools. So we're really leaning in and looking to the available resources that we can get from New York State Ag and Markets grants, other farm to school grants, to see what we can do for staffing, what we can do so that the school staff have the ability to scratch cook more often. And so for some schools, that means they need staffings. For some school, that means they need different equipment or training, as Denise was saying. So really just trying to get the resources into the county where we can, and trying to do that a little more creatively, working on applications. So I'm always available to help with researching, writing grants, and things like that.
Yeah. And think about when you go out to eat, right? So if you go to a restaurant and you have a nice experience and it's got a good vibe, a good atmosphere, the food is good, the service is good, you're likely to go back there. Now, translate that to a school cafeteria where everything is fast and loud and intense, and there's, you know, everything in school moves so quickly. So we want to create an experience in the cafeteria that is enjoyable and educational. And we've been very, really pleased with the response we've received so far and the interest from our school partners in making that happen.
And students are encouraged to apply in cooperation with their school leadership.
Yeah,
too.
Absolutely. We have a through the USDA grant, we have a youth-led farm-to-school initiative grant. So we're putting it back to the schools to say, here is a grant program, get your students involved. So, you know, it's not enough to just say, I hate school lunch, it's awful. But what would you do about it? What would you change if you could? And we're focusing these grants more on the eating side, like in the kind of the cafe, we're calling them cafes, because a lot of what happens in the prep side requires a different approach through, you know, the regulations and the nutrition guidelines, and that's a slower process. So one of the grants we funded, for example, is CCHS, the Homestead School in Hurleyville, and they installed an outdoor kitchen so that they could prepare food from their garden for snacks. So they're taking food that they're growing through the Catskill Edible Garden Project, which is another program that we work with, and then they're preparing it for snack for the students there. So it's very much about the youth not only growing the food, but them also preparing and enjoying it.
Cassandra, there was a two-day conference in August, late August, with school food service professionals. And what did they? What did you hear? What did they tell you?
You know, one of the best things that we heard was that they all just really enjoyed coming together and being able to share their resources, to be able to share what they're doing in their cafeterias. Some of the schools are doing excellent. They're already scratch cooking a lot of what they have. So the other employees are getting to learn what they're doing. And they also really just enjoyed hearing about the nutritional aspect of the food and how different ways to incorporate different foods that you wouldn't necessarily think you're going to find in a school cafeteria. Mm-hmm. Butternut squash mac and cheese, huge hit from the adults and the kids alike. So, you know, the little things that they could do, they were just really enthusiastic, and it was really beautiful to see them all come together with this same mindset.
What are some of the challenges that they have to help bring this? Is it just like scale, volume of product or daily or?
Yeah. So, you know, like most of the things these days, staffing, having enough staff, because when you're scratch cooking, there's a lot of prep that goes in. You know, cutting carrots for your family is one thing. Cutting carrots for 300 people is a whole different scale.
Versus like opening a giant bulk, you know, can of carrots too, right?
So we're trying to change. So we know that's an issue. So we're working with the Catskills Food Hub to think, okay, can you, if the food hub were to get a big, I use carrots as an example a lot, but if they got a big, you know, this big delivery of carrots, could they get them into a form that would make it easier for the schools to use them? Mm-hmm. So prep and staffing. And then, of course, because schools have been operating a certain way for such a long time, when you're looking at scratch cooking, you have to look at your equipment, and it's a different equipment for, you know, cooking from scratch than just reheating things that come from a central place. So we're looking at equipment. And then we're also looking at changing the mindset. And that's why the conference was brilliant, because helping people who are doing the work understand why it's important and valuable, and then translating that to the students, like, try these carrots. These are delicious. And these were grown by Eugene down the road. And just maybe that full circle conversation around food, it going back to how we used to appreciate our food. Food is medicine. We know that healthier food adds to better educational outcomes, better behavioral, mental health. It's all related. We're really excited that most of our schools have salad bars, and salad bars are a great place to start with tasting. And during Farm to School Month, many of our schools are doing sampling of things that they might not ordinarily have on the menu. And of course, in this month is also the Big Apple Crunch, which is the day that everyone takes a bite out of a New York apple at the same time. So it's symbolic and it's kind of hokey and fun. But eating an apple that was grown at Majestic Farm in Mountaindale tastes a lot different than eating an apple that traveled on a truck from Washington State across the country.
Yeah.
And it's really as simple as that.
And that education component of it is so important. You mentioned that it is Farm to School Month. What's coming up this month, and then what's kind of coming up on deck for the school year? You're with the calendar year of the school yes. cycle, so we're at the beginning of that. What's coming up?
Excuse me. So Farm to School Month, several of our schools are participating in the Big Apple Crunch, as I mentioned. Sullivan West is making a whole day of Farm to School Month where they're really trying to, this is on October 17th, bringing in a lot of resources to introduce food in a different way. So having farmers there, highlighting the garden at their school, the Catskill Edible Garden Project, and making that connection to understanding where your food comes from. And then it's just a way for us to continue the conversation and really highlight what's going on and what's up next. For us, we're going to keep doing this work. Cassandra's writing grants. We have a couple of really great grants out there that will be transformative if we are successful in securing them. And then we'll talk more about it later because it's kind of a secret, but we're trying to do almost an extreme makeover for a cafeteria on the side where you would be in, you know, the eating side. So where the students get to enjoy their lunch. Imagine makeover.
The location. You mean where they sit.
Where they sit.
I see. Oh.
So you go to school on Friday and it looks one way, and you come back on Monday and it looks completely different.
That's fun.
Yeah.
You'll tell us more about that when you come back. Where can folks get more information? And are you looking for folks to participate in any way that maybe are not related to the schools?
Yeah, so we definitely check out our website, sullivan180.org. You can also get into contact with Denise or I about initiatives, but we're really looking to engage the children and their parents. It's a wonderful thing to see it all happen in the cafeterias. Kids spend a lot of time in their day in the cafeteria or in the schools, but parents can really engage and would benefit so much from learning this information, helping out. They bring a whole different perspective and a different resource. They might have connections otherwise, so we would love to engage with their families.
Yeah. That's Cassandra Johnstone and Denise Frangipani from Sullivan 180, part of the Sullivan Nutrition Action Coalition. It's a farm-to-school community-based movement to create a better future through access to healthier food for children. Thank you guys so much.
It's grateful bon
for
appetit.
You being. Bon appetit. Bon appetit. I want to go to one of those salad bars. All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, the Lark in the Park. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
In nearly every presidential election this century, Wisconsin has been decided by less than a percentage point. Vice President Kamala Harris hopes the state will help restore the Democrats' so-called blue wall, while former President Donald Trump aims to break through it like he did in 2016. I'm Ari Shapiro, our reporting from right here in Wisconsin, all this week on All Things Considered from NPR News.
On Radio Catskill, your NPR station, keeping you connected this election season.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. All five counties in the Catskill Park will be celebrating the 20th annual Lark in the Park. It's 10 days of guided outings and programs, and it starts this Saturday and runs through October 14th. Lisa Lyons of Morgan Outdoors is leading a map reading for beginners and a loop-de-loop hike as part of Lark in the Park, and she's joining us now with more. Lisa, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Tim. It's really great to be on the radio with you to to shine a little light on this incredible week of stuff.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I mentioned it's the 20th annual Lark in the Park, but for folks who may have been under a rock and not larking, can you tell us what the Lark in the Park is all about?
Just go back to 2004 and imagine that it's the 100th anniversary of the Catskill Park, 700,000 acres in our backyard, public land owned by, you know, it's the taxpayers that made it happen and some very smart people. And so we have taken it from 2004 through today with 10 days each and every year, same time. And this particular year, being the 20th anniversary, isn't it kind of Mother Nature to give us good weather?
Yes.
Because we're going to have it for a lot of these days. So I just picked two very different types of events, both aimed toward beginners, which is another reason why it's nice to mention it on the radio, because it's a great way to try something that you have never tried. And you have a wonderful guide to welcome you, to show you the ropes, and to make sure that you're having fun.
And tell us about that. Yeah, I was going to say, tell us about those two ones, the topography map reading for beginners. Yeah. Is that right?
Yes. Well, many people are not having map reading skills. And if you would like to go out and enjoy a Catskill walk or hike, it's really great to be able to read a topographic map, which is even more specific. And it's so easy to learn how to read them. You just have to have somebody be your guide. So I have a perfect size little table. Five people will join me if they'd like to on Friday, the 11th of October, 5:30 to 6:30. So possibly a working person could come. And it also doesn't butt in with your Friday night. And I should make sure I mention the website a couple of times. It's Catskills Lark. .org, Catskills with an S, LARK.org, and you'll see an incredible array of opportunities there to get to know a different part of the Catskills, to do something easy, medium, or hard. There's even an event on Saturday called the Cross Mountain Crusher, a gravel and road bike ride. But I'll mention just, if you want me to, Tim, the hike I'll do on Tuesday,
October 8th. Yeah, I was going to ask you about the hike that you're doing, the Loop-de-Loop hike. That's around Frick Pond in Livingston Manor?
Yeah, not far at all. Really easy to find in Mongop State Park. What's beautiful about this is that in the autumn, with the colors on the trees, and there are many different types of trees that grow there, you look across Frick Pond, and it's the most beautiful reflections of autumn colors. It's just a gorgeous place to be. I love the chance to bring people there that have never gone. The loop is 2.2 miles long, but it's not much in the way of elevation change. So if people register for it, they get to talk to me about the specifics so they make sure it fits them. And I can give them a couple of tips to make it even more pleasant. And yeah. So that's the thing. I encourage people to think about registering. Once they do, feel very comfortable getting in touch with the leader with any questions you might have, because then you'll have a much better chance of having a great time.
Yeah, and on the website, like as you mentioned, catskillslark.org, there's a list of the 2024 schedule, which, as I mentioned, starts this Saturday and runs all the way through the 14th. And such a variety of events throughout the five counties that encompass Catskills Park: paddling, hiking, bike riding, scenic walks, yoga, so many things that are going on, and what a great way to experience it. Lisa, if folks want to get more information for your specific events that are happening here in our area, do they also just go to catskillslark.org, or should they reach out to you,
they
or both?
They do. Yep. No, I wrote a very detailed description there. So you look for the date and the time, or the name rather. Loop de loop is helpful. Topo map reading is helpful. And then you get right to it, and it'll give you a phone number to contact me and a way to quickly register. Easy, easy peasy.
Yeah, and all of those events, if you click on the link to whichever event you're interested in, it has all the details, event durations, level of difficulties, the leaders, you know, whether pets are allowed or not, questions, driving directions, and all that. That's at CatskillsLark.org. And what a great time of the year to do this. As you mentioned, Lisa Lyons from Morgan Outdoors talking to us about the 20th annual Lark in the Park. Thank you so much. And is the proper way to say this, happy larking?
For you, absolutely.
Okay, great. Lisa Lyons, thank you so much.
Tim.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. This is Radio Chatskill. And for the final production of their 2024 season, River Rep Theater is presenting MacArthur genius Larissa Fast Horse's hit comedy, The Thanksgiving Play. It follows a troupe of well-intentioned theater people as they scramble to create a pageant that somehow manages to celebrate both Turkey Day and Native American Heritage Month. It doesn't go quite right. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke to River Rep's Christopher Pedito and performers from the not quite politically correct Thanksgiving play.
Good morning and welcome to Radio Chatskill. Chris, you are back with your performers who are going to be in your upcoming play, the Thanksgiving play.
Indeed. Thank you, Valerie. Thanks for having us back.
Tell us about the play, the performers.
Well, this is our last show of the 2024 season, Valerie. We're extremely excited to be doing a premiere here. Certainly in the Catskills area. Well, probably let's just confine it to the Sullivan Catskills because this is one of the most produced plays actually in the country by a playwright named Larissa Fasthorse, who is the first Native American playwright, female playwright, to have a play done on Broadway. And this play of hers, you know, it's a wonderful, biting satire of wokeness is maybe the short version. And we have a tremendous cast in the room with us. Lexi McEntee is here. We've got Amy Laird Webb. Arthur Alisi, the Associate Artistic Director of River Rep, is in the cast, as well as Josh Livright, another actor new to the company, working with us for the first time. And it's a wonderful piece about four theater makers who are scrambling to try and put together a pageant for a elementary school production that celebrates both Native American Heritage Month and Thanksgiving. So you have these four very well-intentioned theater people who are trying to create this, how should we say, PC play for kids. And the kind of travails and hilarious craziness that happens on the road to creating that play.
Well, do they have any input from Indigenous people?
Well, this is part of the comedy, and Lexi's character. Without revealing too much, part of the humor is discovering that Lexi's character. Uh-huh. Who Amy's character? Amy plays the director in this show, and to her chagrin, she discovers. What do you discover, Amy? About
well, I don't know how do we say without giving away the coup de théâtre. I just say that she thinks she has secured some very valuable input from an Indigenous person, and then when she finds out that's not the case, she is scrambling to justify moving forward.
There's a lot going on. You know, you know how it is, Valerie. We don't want to give too much away. We want the audience to come and discover it. But some other, I suppose the real discussion underneath it, you know, she, Larissa Fasthorse, wrote this play in a way as a sort of reaction to her trying to get her other plays done that featured Native American characters and being told her plays were unproducible because of that. So in a way, this play is kind of making fun, lampooning, you know, our climate of how should we say, trying to do good, but perhaps doing as much or more not serving good through trying to do good. Well, so that's the paradox and the comedy of it. It
almost sounds like the saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Exactly.
Exactly.
good.
Yeah.
Lexi's character, because I would love to bring Lexi into this conversation.
Yes, Lexi.
You know, she her character is very interesting and different than the others in that she's not, how should we say, terminally woke. How would you describe your character, Lexi?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to describe her as not that. And she's brought on, as Amy kind of insinuated, as to be this Native American compass, which turns out that she is not. But she is a compass in another way, in terms of like this kind of more like rational, grounded approach, when these other characters are kind of, you know, much more in their heads about, I think, the how it looks externally, right, rather than what the actual work they're doing of putting on a play. Like, she's very grounded. This is a school play for Thanksgiving, my character is. And the other characters seem to get a little bit lost in what this means, like the larger image of what this means for them, for what it looks like to others. And my character is a little less that, and is more of like, well, isn't this just a play, you
right.
know, rather than like a huge political statement.
Yeah, the performative wokeness aspect of it, as the playwright has spoken about this play, she talks about performative wokeness. And I think that's a big part of what we explore
in
this.
Can you explain?
Well, this, again, this notion of, you know, do-gooders and doing good. Mm-hmm. These characters, in a lot of way, are sort of trying with the best of intentions to use the lingo, hold space for Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because the debate that unfolds over the course of the play is that they really discover their own sort of absurd assumptions about Native Americanness and what it means to represent and what it means for white people to try and do a play about another people's culture. And are we continuing to keep Native American voices out of the space? And in the case of this play, it's literally they have no space in the space that the play is being created.
I think it also shows really clearly ways in which we have difficulty in our country and in our culture in talking about some of the aspects of our history. And even folks who, like me, who think of themselves as able and open to talking and about these kinds of issues, I can feel implicated by some of the satire in the play in terms of, looking at what one's intentions are, you know, are one's intentions to be good and to seem good and to look good, or and that's a lot of what's happening in the play.
You're delving into some very, very, very deep territory.
Well, yeah. We want to disturb people, Valerie. Yeah. You know, River Rep's mission is to do adventurous work. And we want to, you know, we all should look at ourselves, like Amy is saying. In a way, I see lots of myself in the play, both as the kind of pretentiousness of the theater makers, mm-hmm. which she makes fun of, how serious we can be about making theater and the language we use. And I think everyone in the audience, hopefully, is going to see something of themselves in these characters and ask themselves these same questions that the characters in the play are asking, you know, am I really as aware of, you know, what are my own assumptions about these people? And it's fascinating.
Well, I think that it's an ongoing process for all of us, that we don't reach understanding. It's a constant evolution. We learn as we go, and we can't know everything.
but we have to be open to
and feeling able to acknowledge that we don't
that's
know everything.
That's the hard part.
I think that's a challenge for a lot of people.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of the humor in this play lies.
Yeah.
In seeing people struggling with what they don't know or understand and trying to compensate for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of like I said earlier, you know, there'll be a lot of laughing at ourselves.
We hope. And maybe some cringing.
Definitely. Yeah.
You know, you kind of cringe at these characters in the way that you cringe, let's say, at Ricky Gervais in The Office.
Okay.
These characters have that, where they're turning themselves, you know, twisting themselves into knots, trying to be so politically correct. And you look at them and the language they're using, and it's extremely funny. And hopefully it can make all of us, be a little more sensitive. What's the word?
Cognizant.
That's a dangerous word.
Cognitive.
Sensitivity. Yeah, to be more cognizant of these things, certainly. And laugh at ourselves.
Yeah. And be willing to change.
Yes. And it really is a very funny play, not to give the audience the sense that this is some intellectual exercise. It actually is the playwright calls it a farce or a satire within a comedy. And I think that's a great way to look at it.
Okay. Before we go, can you just briefly tell us a little bit more about the playwright herself?
Well, again, she is a MacArthur Genius Award.
Okay.
Has been awarded a MacArthur Genius. So she's an extremely, I guess you could say she's on that short list of playwrights. I believe this play put her into this category of top 10 most produced plays ever. The first time a Native American writer has ever made that kind of list. And the play has really started incredible conversation all across the country in dozens of productions. We are not the first to do this play. And she has, since the success of this play, she's doing all kinds of work now in Hollywood as well. She's writing on series, but her first love is theater. I was so excited to find this text, find this play, and to be able to find actors here who so wonderfully are embodying these characters. They really are these four people. River Rep is still a very young company. This is our third season. We do these shows on micro budgets, and we do it for the community, for people to come. And we really so appreciate that folks are going to come to beautiful Lake Huntington and come into this beautiful old space and share in that space. And that whole idea is in the heart of all of it, is doing this for the live audiences, which we really, really love to do.
And more information can be found at your website,
riverrep.org. We're doing two Saturdays,
the
5th and the 12th at 8 p.m., and then two Sunday matinees, the 6th and the 13th at 2 p.m. So the 5th through the 13th at the Delaware Valley Opera Center in beautiful, beautiful Lake Huntington. Come and hang out on the balcony and look out at the lake and share in some great theater, we hope.
Okay, well, thank you, all of you, for coming in, and thank you for the work you're doing. And sharing it with our community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Valerie.
And thanks to cultural reporter Valerie Manzi. And that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A programming reminder that our election 2024 coverage continues. Our series of meeting local candidates continuing tonight with Michelle Frazier, the Democrat challenging incumbent Peter Oberrocker for New York State Senate seat in the 51st District. You can hear that on the local edition tonight at 6, and then tomorrow on the local edition, we'll hear from Senator Peter Oberrocker. And next week, mark the calendar, October 10th, we'll bring you the debate between New York 19th candidates for the congressional seat in New York 19, Mark Molinaro, the Republican incumbent, and Josh Riley. That's coming up next week here on Radio Catskill as we keep you connected this election season. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated,
presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
The Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce presents Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th, Fireman's Field, Narrowsburg, featuring the New York State Lumberjack Association's Lumberjack Contest, Beard and Mustache Contest, Axe Throwing, Line Dancing Lessons, Baking Contest, Kids Activities, Beer Garden, Food, and more. Logging Days, 11 to 5, Saturday, October 5th in Narrowsburg. More information at WelcomeToNarrowsburg.com. Paid for by the Narrowsburg Chamber of Commerce.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, clouds cooler, a little bit of sun poking through at times, but also the possibility of a shower at times. Happy fall. It's going to be 59 for a high today, 51's the low tonight. Some fog and low clouds lingering through till the morning tomorrow with a high of 68, partly sunny. More fog around on Friday as well, high 71, partly sunny skies. And for the weekend, looking nice, 68 the high both Saturday, Sunday with periods of sun. It's 11 o'clock.